Socks on 35th is next. Doors open on the left.
How's it going, everybody? My name is Duke Coughlin, and welcome to the Socks on 35th podcast. We are back with another exciting episode covering your Chicago White Sox. I'm joined this week by our panelist, Jordan Lazaski, and for the very first time, Socks on 35th contributor, Brett Hafner. Brett, welcome to the show. It's always nice to have the first timers around. Michael Suero has been a first timer on this podcast at least 8 times now, so it's always an honor to get somebody else on the pod.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Duke. It's awesome to be here. I've been a part of Sox Twitter for the last year or so, and super stoked to be part of the team. So really enjoying my time on Section 35th so far. So excited to chat Sox.
Love to hear it, buddy. Love to hear it. Laz, you are noticeably quiet. You usually have talked at least 17 paragraphs by this point in the podcast. So what is on your mind?
No, I was just giving a new guy a chance to talk instead of having to listen to me. Fun fact for today, because I've been better with those. You know how, like, when it rains and you can, like, smell that it's rained in the air and in the grass and all that stuff? Do you know our ability to smell that as humans is greater than a shark's ability to smell blood in water? Fun fact for you for the day.
That's very fitting considering the Chicago White Sox can't smell blood in the water ever. So that is very, very thoughtful. I feel smarter for knowing this, even though it's completely useless to my everyday life, but I appreciate it.
Oh, of course. I'm glad you teed it up better than I did. I just found the fun fact. I didn't have, like, a nice transition, so thank you for that.
Yeah, you guys planned this. That was a hell of a segue into this there. Wow.
Always off the cuff, dude. Me and Laz are always off the cuff. Very, very limited is scheduled on the 35th podcast. I can promise you that. But we have quite a bit to cover in this episode. But before we get started, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to check out the website, socksonthirtyfifth.com, as well as following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at socksonthirtyfifth. Gentlemen, we have relevant White Sox things to talk about. Not only did the Chicago White Sox find a way to win a game, within a 2 to 3 week stretch, yay, Southside stand up. But we actually swept a team. We swept the Rays. Like, what planet is this? I mean, the Rays are kind of nosediving to start the season, but knowing them, they'll find a way to turn it around. Regardless, it's kind of a nice win to have to maybe gain a little bit of momentum. But then we turn around and get swept immediately. And then we have this Cardinals series where we actually won the series. So the White Sox are in a situation where we watched a lot of terrible, like, awful baseball to start the season, and it's still not good, but it's enough to win a game here and there.
You know, like you said before, we saw a lot of games where we just saw absolute piss poor baseball, there was so much lacking in the White Sox game for, these first, like, 3-4 weeks of the season. But to me, it kind of feels like the guys are string together, a couple games where, they're getting double digit hits, in the Rays series. I think the one thing that stood out to me was that we were just seeing a bunch of guys, getting multiple hits throughout the whole lineup. Like, even the first game, like, 5 guys had multiple hits in the game, they were just stringing together all this momentum. And it just felt like some sound level of baseball, which kind of hard to guess with what we saw for this first month of the season. So there's just been these encouraging stretches that we've had for these last 3 series, but we haven't been able, as you saw in the Twins series, closing some of those games out. We weren't really able to do that.
I think it's worth sitting and having a conversation, and I don't know if there's necessarily a good answer to it, but what's up with the inability to play against the AL Central? It's kind of concerning. It's something where, at the end of the day, this is not a competitive season. I don't really care. The highs can't get too high, the lows too low, whatever. At the same time, though, you have a team that can't seem to beat its own division. And the teams are decent in it. That's fair. But I think this has been a historical problem. And I think it's something where, come whenever this team's competitive again, it's at least something to monitor. I don't know if it's bad scouting within the division or within Major League Baseball as well. Even when they're playing better baseball, they can't seem to do it, especially in those close situations against the teams where arguably it should matter most, the teams where you can make a huge swing in the division. It's nice to see them playing better. It's nice for them to be above 500 over the past 9 games or so, but there's still concern in it, and you're still trying to pick the positives out of it. I get it, but that's at least one takeaway from my side.
Boys, we've played 6 series against AL Central teams. 1 win.
Right.
1 win out of 6 series. Not series wins, an individual game win. Like, that's how poor we're talking here. All the other wins have come from non-AL Central teams. It's pretty absurd, if you ask me.
Right, and that's where you have to sit, and it begs the question, at what point is there something you need to do differently within your division? You know, there's different scouts for Major League, Minor League, within the division, out of the division, whatever. God, maybe I'm making this up. I could have sworn that they tried to shuffle some of their Major League scouting who did some more of the interdivision stuff. I don't know if that's true. I just know it's something that, you know, probably doesn't get as much mention now just because, oh, they're historically bad. This is the worst start they've ever had to the season. And what gets lost in it is so much of it is coming from an AL Central that's decent but not great, and you're losing a lot of ball games that you're either in and you just can't close it down, or you just get blown out. It's like that screams scouting to me in many ways, simply because especially those one run games, are you doing the matchups the right way? Are you thinking about this the right way? I guess it gets back to the manager at a certain point too, when you can't win the one run ball games, but that's already been an issue since day one. So it's a culmination of things that ends up saying, yes, awesome past couple series, but let's pour some cold water on it when it looks from a division standpoint.
Well, Laz, and I think you touched on something really important about the idea of it being a historical problem, because it kind of is. You know, even when this team has been competitive in those short spurts in, say, the last 20 plus years, we've been able to beat the division. But outside of that, it's been pretty brutal, like pretty rough shot. You know, even in 2021, I feel like we couldn't have been all that great against the division. You know, we were in a situation where I believe we were letting the Twins and Cleveland kind of stay in the race there towards the end. And, you know, it's continues to be a problem. Because those teams see us more, is it a situation where they kind of know how to, you know, handle being behind against us? Because it's not like we got blown out in all the AL Central games that we've played so far this season. For the most part, a lot of them have come down to the seventh, eighth, ninth inning. You know, that's something that maybe you could put on the bullpen. Obviously, I'm somebody who's going to put that a little bit more on Pedro Grifol, because I'm totally under the belief he doesn't know how to manage a bullpen. But it is concerning because, you know, as you said, even if this team were to find a way to start competing down the road, it's not going to matter if you can't win the games you need to win. And, you know, not to jump too much like to praise Ozzie Guillen here, but we didn't necessarily have this problem in that era of Ozzie Guillen, whereas we've had this problem before it and a lot after it. And it just continues. And it's not like the AL Central is heavy hitters. We haven't had a team that's really stood out in the AL Central now for at least 5 years.
My concern in that statement is the idea that, oh, you know, maybe the teams see the Sox more, but in the same vein, the Sox see the other teams more. Like, they shouldn't have the issues. It should at least kind of, especially in the one-run games, you'd hope it eventually evens out. At least that's in theory. Now, obviously, you don't want to give the manager too much credit nor too much blame, but at a certain point, there comes a number, and I don't know what the number is. I think you're going to have to look at a resume to figure it out. There comes a point where, you know, the players play, the players perform, the managers put them in the situation, and there's either talent or there's not, and there's either you're put in the right situation or you're not. A lot of that, I think I do. If I'm going to start looking at, for the lack of a better term, building a resume or tearing down a resume for a manager, that's where I personally like to start. Simply because it feels like in those games, you've made a decision or two that has a fairly heavy effect on the outcome. And 3-run games, 4-run games, yeah, those still exist. You still made decisions that probably swayed it one way or another. but it's easiest to find those in a one-run game, for good or for bad. And I think that's where the Pedro Grifol tenure or anyone outside of the past or the future moving forward for the White Sox, you do have to start getting judged on those in the AL Central as well.
Well, and Brett, you can attest to this. The Detroit game that we went to, I believe it was the first Saturday game we had, the White Sox very much should have won that ball game, and it was a situation where they were just a couple moves in that game, coaching-wise, specifically the hit and run for Eloy Jimenez to go to second base that flat out didn't pan out and kind of killed momentum and a potential RBI opportunity that could have been coming up later in the inning or later in the lineup. It's situations like that that we're just seeing far too often. And then we're seeing situations where he puts, say, a guy like Jordan Leisure in for an inning. He looks great. Or probably the most mind-boggling of everything, the timing of him putting Michael Kopech in, usually in the seventh to eighth inning, or sometimes putting him in the eighth inning to finish the game. It really just makes you wonder how much of those decisions really affect the bottom line of where a win-loss record is. You know, I can't sit here and deny the talent on the team that's obviously not performing. You know, Brett, before we started on the podcast, you said it was kind of like beating a dead horse. You know, obviously a guy like Andrew Benintendi's getting going. Corey Lee is showing that he belongs in the major leagues, but we are still continuing to find ways to lose very winnable games. And it'd be a lot different if the White Sox were getting blown out every single game. I'd probably be a lot more behind the idea that this is the worst baseball team I've ever seen. But when we lose these tight games as often as we do, it's why I personally get so honed in on a guy like Pedro Grifol.
I don't know. It's still the worst baseball team I've ever seen. I don't think the changes in one-run games reflects a difference for it in me. It's more so the standpoint of, you know, there's enough talent to make them competitive. There's enough talent that pitchers can put it together and you can squint and you can kind of figure it out. I don't think that the whether it's blowouts or one-run games, I don't think that changes it for me. I think it's just more so you're in that situation. Certainly, there's enough talent that you should be doing better in one-run or even close games in general games than you are, personally.
And I even think, like, the shutouts are what's doing it for me. Like, the rate that, you know, the rate that these guys are getting shut out at is obviously, you know, pretty historically bad. And yeah, we've seen some days where, you know, they can come, but I just, you know, even look at like the first Cardinals game, for example. They face a dude like Sonny Gray, a very legit pitcher on a really nice run right now. And yeah, they're not going to hit against him. But, you know, we look back across this whole season so far, and, you know, these shutouts are kind of just, they're really kind of serving as a reflection at sometimes of like, man, you know, at least they're not happening as often now. That's all I can say. At least they're happening at a little bit slower rate.
And even with the shutouts and everything, and here's where I'll kind of turn and give a little bit more credit to what I'm seeing on the field recently in terms of just play as well as, you know, the people in the dugout. For as bad as this team is, for the first time, I'm not sure that the hitting coach is doing a bad job. I think this team, with under Marcus Thames, is swinging at bad stuff less. And I think you're seeing that in terms of guys, and I know Duke, he's one of your favorite, like a Corey Lee, who's swinging less at bad stuff this year. The team in general is doing that. Now they're not perfect. They still hit a lot of ground balls. But for the first time in a while, you're seeing progress in the correct direction. Now, is that simply because there's different players in here who don't have the same bad tendencies as those of old? Maybe. Maybe once Robert and Jimenez and Moncada get healthy, you can kind of test that experiment a little bit further. But for the first time in a long time with the White Sox, it feels like there's positive things going on offensively that isn't just singling teams to death. Now, they're doing plenty of that at the same time, but in terms of swing decisions, I guess, and Corey Lee's probably the best example currently, there seems to be legitimate progress, which is a good thing.
So I quick looked it up with the one run game argument. So we are 4-8 in one run games. We've scored 46 runs in those games and we've allowed 50 in those games. That's tight enough. The fact that we've had 12 of those games and 8 of them haven't gone in our favor, that those are the types of games where one decision can really tip the scales. You know, I'm not saying I don't want to, again, I don't want to try to get away from blame from any of the players, because, you know, like you said, even with guys not swinging as bad of pitches, which I think bringing in our hitting coach was a very good idea, considering he was a above average at times hitter. You know, he had had streaks where he was actually capable compared to the other hitting coaches we were kind of bringing in. There's too many situations where I feel like there's just very winnable games on the field that we're just not taking advantage of, you know. And it's nice to see in the St. Louis series, you know, like the 6-5 game on Saturday, obviously, that took what, 7 hours to finish because of the rain delay. That was a good showing of what we can do when we win those games, you know, play tight, play until the absolute end, you know. A little bit of clutch batting wouldn't kill this team. And obviously, you know, the manager's not out there swinging the bat, but we got to be able to put these guys in situations to succeed. And I think 4-8 in one run games, I think any team you're on, even if you have a winning record, with that record in one run games, that's still going to be something that's going to be painfully obvious. It's going to be something that is going to be looked at very lowly. And then even the interleague play, 2-8, 21 runs scored to 70 runs allowed. Like, that's absolutely brutal. Kicking off to a little bit of a different subject. So John Schriffen has been getting absolutely devastated on Twitter, on Facebook. Boomers, young people, everyone is complaining about him. They are saying that he's corny in the booth. They're saying he's too excitable. They're saying he talks about things that aren't relevant to the baseball game. And they're saying a lot of things I heard people say about Jason Benetti when he took over for Hawk Harrelson, you know. And while there might be merit to some of it, and while I do think John does get a little bit too uppity in the booth sometimes, I think White Sox fans are maybe being a little bit overboard on this. How do you feel about John Schriffen? Do you think he's a little bit too much? Do you think he can develop into a good play-by-play guy? Do you think people are overreacting? Do you think people are underreacting? Should people be madder? How do you feel about him so far?
I'm kind of taking the approach of, like, people are really frustrated about the product and what's going on right now. And I think that, you know, it just seems like they're kind of like something that they can complain and kind of hold on to this argument of, hey, our team's so bad, why is this guy being so, like, overwhelmingly positive? I don't know. I'm personally, I do really like him, you know? I mean, you know, I'm a little young for really remembering that Hawk era, you know? I'm a pretty young guy, but I just, you know, I got to have a lot of that, you know, Benetti stone for the last bunch of years. And you know what? There were a lot of enjoyable moments. I really liked that duo. It was great. But one thing that on today's broadcast that actually kind of summed up where things are at right now with John Schriffen is Steve Stone makes this joke, and I couldn't tell you what the joke was or whatever, but John Schriffen, like, didn't get it. And John's just like, ah, I really gotta, you know, understand your humor. So I think that it's going to take a little bit of time to develop that dynamic. You know, we're still at a relatively small sample size with him. So I feel like, because we've, you know, obviously he got a lot of flack for the Benintendi call of being super hyped for that. And it was a really fun moment. You know, I'm not going to deny that as a Sox fan. It's great to see a walk off and see something really valuable, like being on the field on that specific moment. But man, like, I just think that it's a little early to be saying, like, for people to be saying how bad he is. It's a little early for that. I think got to reserve a little bit more judgment because we're still at a really small sample size.
My opinion is rather straightforward. Who the hell cares? Why is this a topic?
A lot of people care.
Yeah, people just care way too
much. It's incredible to me. Like, here's my frustration, and I feel like every White Sox podcast is having this conversation this week. It's this great debate. We have turned this into a week, 2-3 week long discussion over John Schriffen. That is the most of all the absurd things that White Sox social media has done, this might be the most absurd. It is ridiculous. It's terrible. It's every day.
It's so drawn out. Like, this could have stopped like a day or two after the Benintendi call, but no, like, we're, you know, nearly 2 weeks later and we're still, people are still just finding their way.
And you've got media outlets writing articles about this 5 days after the home run happened. This thing happened 5 days ago at this point. And now you're writing this article. Oh, it's concerning that he said this about the haters and this and that. No, you're just mad he didn't respond to your request for interviews and he responded to somebody else's. And you wonder why people trust blogs and podcasts over newspapers nowadays. Because you start acting like that. Like you're entitled to get an answer to something that he gave an answer to somebody else already. And then you have local media going and deciding they're going to say, oh, it's concerned, this is bad, you should know all of these things about the White Sox history and Bill Veeck and everything. Like, he's been here a month. Like, that's the reality of the situation. You're just finding things to get mad about now. And that's the worst part of just social media for the White Sox, I guess, in general. And this will be kind of the end of my rant. You can't get mad about everything, folks. Because if you're mad about everything, then the anger just, it doesn't matter anymore. Because then, oh, you're just angry about everything and no one's going to listen to the opinion. And it just doesn't come off well if you're just mad all the time. It just sounds whiny and annoying and you're just looking for something that's going to get you clicks and it's going to get you retweets and likes because everybody's so mad right now.
I've just described this as like, it's aimless. Like, there's no reason
Exactly.
There's no reason for it.
It's like, it's have an opinion, but have a nuanced opinion to it. Like, we can all be mad about how this team sucks. And I'm not saying Schifrin's the best announcer ever. I'm saying he's been here for a month. He probably hasn't called a lot of baseball. It's kind of clear. But the idea that he doesn't have baseball knowledge, this was a guy who was a walk-on at Dartmouth until he hurt his arm. He knows baseball. It's such a stupid argument. And you're just saying things that don't make any sense and aren't factual at all. It's dumb. The fact that we are here is so dumb.
Yeah, no, it's that, and that's spot on, Laz. Spot on. It is so ridiculous that, like, the amount of people who have used this to just constantly push out content just to complain about him. So I'm not going to say the person who wrote this name. Let's just say he writes for a very highly attributed Chicago newspaper that may have owned a baseball team at one point. Okay, so no hints. This guy went on Facebook, his personal Facebook, to make this statement. It is about six paragraphs long, breaking down why he doesn't like John Schifrin. Like, detail by detail by detail, nitpicking the smallest things. Like, very much was upset about the Veeck thing. You know what? I love that man. Genuinely. My dad told me a lot of great stories from getting a chance to meet him because he's hanging out at the ballpark so much. Like, he's a big part of why Nancy Faust is a thing. He's a big reason why there's a lot of things in baseball are a thing. So no disrespect to him at all, but like, you can't expect everyone to come in and know exactly who that is and what he means to the Chicago White Sox and what he means to the fan base. Like, there are so many people who are diehard baseball fans that I know who have absolutely no idea who he is. They have absolutely no idea his impact on the game because it's kind of been a while since he's been running around doing things in baseball and sports. It's just that simple.
It's just ridiculous. It's the idea that you need to know everything about the White Sox if you're going to work for them or you're going to talk about them or something like that. Making mistakes, especially on live broadcasts, we don't do podcasts live for this. It's easy to make mistakes, and you want to get your things out the way you want them to sound. You don't have that luxury with live anything. So to criticize a person who's consistently live, that is a hard thing to do, especially if you're someone who does things live, and some of the critiquers have been this, who have done things live and make mistakes all the time. It happens. We're humans. Get over it. Like, it's ridiculous to assume he's bad or this sucks or you're just mad to be mad.
Listen, everybody starts somewhere. It's that simple. Imagine being him, being hired to the Chicago White Sox, because of course you're going to take the job because it's an opportunity to move up in your career. Being a play-by-play for any major league team, whether it's baseball, football, anything, it's a big step. To think that he's going to come in day one, know everything about the team is ridiculous. But outside of that, having this idea that he's going to have immediate chemistry with Steve Stone, he's going to have a home run call ready, he's going to have like a catchphrase ready, like the guy's trying his best. And on top of all of it, it's not like this is, you know, a situation where a longtime announcer is retiring from a great team that's well known. He's coming into the 2024 Chicago White Sox and he's trying. He's doing everything he can to make it so this is something that people should watch every week or watch every game and tune into. Like, he's being given a very difficult job. And like the people before him, Jason Benetti, he commentated in the minors for the White Sox. So he knew all of the young players that were coming in. Like, he had such an advantage coming into that. And even then, Benetti got killed for not having a home run call because Hawk Harrelson had such an obvious home run call, being overexcited in bad seasons because, newsflash, Jason Benetti, when he came here, the White Sox were really bad and they were bad for years, yet Jason Benetti brought it every single broadcast. There was never a broadcast where Jason Benetti was like, yeah, well, you know, the White Sox hit a single. Well, we're like 20 games under 500. Woohoo, we win. You know what I mean? Like, never a scenario of that. Like, I could definitely pull up clips. I could pull up clips of Hawk Harrelson 20 years into the job, like, ready to jump out of his seat on a walk-off home run when the playoffs were decided, like, 3 weeks before. Like, it's not that crazy. People are just genuinely getting upset to be upset about something. It is the most annoying thing in the world. They're not even trying to give the guy a chance. It's just super similar to when Jason Benetti came on. Because people did the same thing to him and people ended up loving Jason Benetti. Like, everyone who loved Jason Benetti is the ones that are complaining about John. And I guarantee you they were the people that loved Hawk and hated Jason when he first came in.
I think at the end of the day, there's always going to be comparisons. There's always going to be this and that. And it's been a month. Let's get back to that idea that it has been a month. I don't know. It is crazy to me that we have such strongly formed opinions over an announcer who's a month into this. It's wild to me, and it's frustrating, but I can't do anything about it.
And being on like Twitter right now, it just feels like, okay, what side are you on? Like, are you a Southside stander? Do you stand with Southside Stand Up? Or are you like just not a fan of the enthusiasm? Like, why are we picking sides? Like, it's just, you know, it's a little frustrating.
Honestly, like, I started tweeting out Southside Stand Up when we won our first couple games just because I knew it would get under people's skin. But it's kind of growing on me now. Like, just because I know it gets under people's skin and it's like, all right, you know what? I appreciate that he's trying, even if it doesn't end up sticking. That's like, yeah. All right. I've already beaten the dead horse, but Benetti used to try home run call in his first year when he was working, like kind of doing games for Hawk every once in a while. And it was atrocious. I can't remember what it was off the top of my head, but just say it didn't stick. But you want to know what? The great ones throw shit at a wall until something does.
But here's the thing. Now Southside Stand Up is like, it's known. People know it, even if they love it or hate it. Like, it's, you know, and maybe a while from now, that is the call, you know? But again, this comes back to the same thing. Small sample size, you know, there's got to be some more big moments where a Southside Stand Up just absolutely hits, you know? And sometimes we'll have to see. We'll just have to see.
So that actually brings me great to my next point. Small sample size, big moments. Brian Ramos got his first start against St. Louis and he got his first RBI. Obviously, it's something that hasn't been discussed because it was more of a negative thing that happened, but he did have a brutal throw in his first major league defensive play to Corey Lee. I wouldn't say cost us a run. It just wasn't a great throw there. It was a really really quick play. It's one of those things that's just kind of naturally going to happen. But Brian Ramos is a guy that went directly from double A to the majors. Steve Stone, bless his heart, was trying so hard to hype up Brian Ramos before his debut. And then they put the double A stats on there, and Steve just genuinely didn't know what to say from there. I give him a lot of the credit in the world, but like, he is obviously a guy who struggled in double A, but he's also somebody that we've seen show a lot of potential with both his bat and potentially with his glove moving forward. How do you guys feel about Brian Ramos? Do you think this is something where he can find a way to stick if he plays well enough? I do think him starting in just his second game was a pretty big endorsement, but it still does kind of feel like he's just going to get sent back down after Danny Mendick. How do you feel about it?
Well, your last point there kind of summed up what I'm thinking a little bit here. If we've learned anything about the guys who have been getting called up this year, you know, they're going to get a little major league experience, but you know, they're making it pretty clear that we're probably going to see Ramos sent back down in the next, you know, whenever Danny Mendick comes back. I would say more likely than not, we're going to see it. Now, hey, you know what? Give him some at-bats. You know, I think, you know, if he's going to be here, you know, we don't want another Jose Rodriguez situation, you know. But, hey, if he's here, you know, give him some at-bats. Why not? I mean, heck, again, it was cool to see him get a nice quality hit today, you know, when it was in a good situation as well. Getting a good RBI in his first at-bat as well. But he's here. You know, someone's got to play the position. That's the kind of thing we got to worry about now. Someone's got to play the position for a couple days.
I just don't want it to become a Jose Rodriguez situation where everyone gets mad that he doesn't play. But the reality is it's a player who's probably not really ready to be here yet. Who's going to get some time and is going to be sent down. And it's going to be okay, because he's just the last infielder available on the 40-man roster, and that's just how it is. So it was nice to see him get his first hit. It's nice to see him playing a little bit, but I just know people are going to do the exact same thing they did last time. They're going to overreact to him getting sent back down, and oh, why'd you bring him up to only do this, and yada yada, all this bullcrap that I just can't stand, which is frustrating. It's nice to see him here. I hope fans learned from the Jose Rodriguez situation where, yeah, he was the last middle infielder available, just infielder in general available, and a stopgap was needed at the time, and that's how it's going to be treated, and that's fine.
I think people just got to understand, like, there's some consistency here, you know? We're seeing guys come up for a little bit, get a little bit of playing time, and then go back down. And that just kind of seems to be following a trend right now. And you know what? I don't hate it. I think Jordan said it best. Like, it's just not that, it's not that big. Like, it's just kind of a necessary point at this time.
It's also a philosophical thing. And I'm starting to learn a little bit about how I think this team views some of the development, like allowing Jonathan Cannon and Nick Nastrini to come up, get some innings, but both had blow up starts. And Cannon, I believe, had two blow-up starts, and then they were sent down. People will say, let him struggle in the big leagues, get the feel for it, stuff like that. But that's what we said about Andrew Vaughn. Development can't always just happen at the major league level. Sometimes there's things that are easier to work on the minor league side when you have a little bit more time, a little bit more freedom to work on something in a game where the ramifications aren't getting your shit kicked every fifth day because you're working on a different pitch or you're working on sequencing or something mechanical, whatever. There's an element to, hey, get your feet wet, see what it feels like, see what it feels like to be part of this rotation. Struggle a little bit because you're not there yet. Here are the things we need to send you back to work on. Work on it. We'll see you later. There's different philosophies. I'm kind of getting on the side of that one. And I'm understanding a little bit more why Chris Getz might have filled this team with quad A players that they can just shuffle back and forth while they wait for prospects. That's the one thing, kind of along your lines, Brett. Like, let them get a feel for it and then go from there, see what happens.
The only big thing I disagree with in that point, Laz, is the Andrew Vaughn point, because there just was no development of Andrew Vaughn. He was on the major league roster essentially from day one. Due to necessity, due to a wild COVID situation, there's a lot of things you can throw at that, but there was absolutely no development there. And honestly, maybe that's why we're doing things like we are now. We're not just having guys kind of just jump up and stay. You know, then you have like, say, a Lenine Sosa situation where he's been given a lot of opportunities and it just really has not continued to pan out. Hopefully Ramos is just like kind of a trend of bringing highly touted guys up in the system to, like you said, get their feet wet, especially in a season where it's not like we need an immediate replacement for Danny Mendick, because literally Danny Mendick was a replacement for one guy, and the one guy before Danny Mendick was a replacement for another guy. So like, we're way too far down the freaking rabbit hole at this point to be trying to push guys into being there full time. So I'm with you guys on this. I think Danny Mendick, the second he gets back healthy, Ramos is going to get sent down. But this can give us a lot clearer of a view of what Brian Ramos is compared to what we've seen maybe in Double A already this season. And, you know, for one reason or another, Ramos looked a lot better at the plate than I had seen him in the minors. You know, maybe he just needed a little bit of juice in the step. Maybe this is kind of the road that gets him going to Triple A a little bit down the road, and maybe he gets Wes Kath moving a little bit through the system a little bit faster. I don't know, but it is nice to just see sprinkles of these guys. It's nice to see Nastrini get a start. It's nice to see Cannon get a start, you know, just kind of every once in a while, kind of give us a taste a little bit of what the farm's going to be, because it's very obvious that this team isn't competing. And the idea that we need to only save these spots for veterans that can contribute consistently is ridiculous. So I'm with you guys 100% on that. Didn't really get to touch on Andrew Benintendi. I'll pass on that just because everyone should know exactly how I feel about Andrew Benintendi. That is my left fielder. Absolutely love that guy. But another guy that I've historically been a fan of, Michael Kopech, doesn't look too bad in that reliever role. Now, where he should be placed in the bullpen is another discussion. It's something that is going to maybe take a little bit of time to figure out. I genuinely just don't know who's going to take the ninth inning anymore. Anytime I kind of have an idea, it just goes in a completely different direction. What do you make of Michael Kopech's start to the season so far?
I kind of just have like one rhetorical question about this whole Kopech situation is, do they want to make him the closer or not? Like this, you know, do they want to hand him this role? Or are they just going to try to, you know, hey, we're going to give you a 4-out save, a 5-out save, or we're just going to give you the 8th, you know, like it's confusing to me. You know, they're seeing some encouraging things, you know, we do see the classic Michael Kopech come out sometimes and, you know, see walk two guys in a row and get into a sticky situation. But then there's other times that we see 102 on the corners, you know, up in the zone that just guys can't even touch. Like, there's a lot of versions of Michael Kopech we're seeing right now. But I just think it's kind of a little hard to assess some things when he's getting thrown into very many different situations. So it's been a little weird just to kind of see, is this dude our closer? Is he our setup man? Is he everything? Is he just a random stopgap at times? There's a lot of different ways they could go about this, but they haven't decided where they're going to go.
See, that's where I'll disagree a little bit. I feel like they have this idea that he can be a multi-inning closer because of his experience in past seasons as a starter. That's why they keep trying to bring him in the 8th and get him to the 9th. And they said in the Twins series as well, Pedro Grifol was like, hey, you know, we wanted him to pitch the 8th and 9th. We liked him facing those guys in the 8th based on leverage. Cool answer. Like that answer. But based on his performance, we didn't want to stick him out there for the 9th too, so we had to go to somebody else. I like the idea of what... I actually like that idea a lot. It's the problem is Kopech is having these long innings or he can't find his command and his stuff isn't really all there all the time. The fastball is great, but you can't just throw 85% fastballs. The slider still needs some work, and I think they need to work it in a little bit more. They've done better with that, to be fair to them. I like that role, personally. I like the idea of that role. However, if Kopech can't handle it, then yeah, it comes back to the question of, Brett, what do you really want to do? Is this going to be a setup situation? Is this going to be a closing situation? What is this going to end up having to be? The one thing I will say about Grifol in terms of how he handles a bullpen is he treats it in terms of leverage rather than closer must get innings or the ninth inning and the last three outs of the game every time. I like that. And I think he's been fairly consistent with that. It just hasn't worked as much in practice. To now it almost becomes back to, is this going to work or not? And how long do you let yourself try it?
So I'll push back at that, Laz, just for the question. Historically, how many two-inning closers have worked?
But for years and years, there was never really an attempt to do it. It's only a more recent thing where closers are trying to go multiple innings, I guess. It's never been tried historically, so there aren't a lot of cases at which you can either say for or against multi-inning closers.
My biggest argument against, and it kind of goes into the same vein of why you start a guy once every fifth start, you don't want to overwork their arm, especially when they're putting everything into each pitch because they're at the end of the game. Obviously, Michael Kopech, when he was starting, was kind of hovering around maybe 95, 96 on the fastball because he knew he was going to have to try to get through six, seven innings, or at least that's the plan, obviously, ideally. But when you know you're going to go out there and you're only pitching in higher leverage situations, you're going to throw absolutely everything that you have into it. And very obviously, Ethan Katz has set him up to be doing that. Like, he wants Michael to go throw absolute gas, put what, six more miles per hour on his slider. His slider, when he has it, is disgusting because of how fast he can still have it that has movement. Like, it is. That could potentially be even better than his fastball if he finds a way to hone that in. But with how much strain you're putting on that arm and with a closer that you historically want to use consistently because you're winning going into the ninth inning, you want that guy fresh. You know, do I think a guy like Liam Hendricks in his prime could have been a two-inning closer? Absolutely. But I know when Liam's in the ninth, he can throw absolutely everything that he has in the ninth inning and he knows that there's nobody behind him. I think there's enough guys potentially on the back end, you know, Jordan Leisure is an example, that can pitch that eighth inning to put Michael into that situation where he can just go absolutely balls to the wall for one inning. That's the entire idea of a closer. I'm not against like trying to revolutionize the game. You know, I think the Rays did a great job with that with an opener. If I was managing, that's not the way I would do it, but there is obviously benefits to that and it works for them. But the two inning closer is just a lot of strain to ask of a pitcher, especially if he does have that one inning that goes a little bit long. And if that inning's the eighth and you have nobody prepared to go in the ninth to close that down, you are kind of in trouble. And that's your closer. That's
yeah. But it's not that every single time needs to be a two-inning save. It's more so the idea that, hey, it comes back to leverage. If my biggest outs potentially are going to come against the 3, 4, 5 hitters and they happen to come up in the eighth, why am I going to save my closer, who's my best guy, for the ninth when I might not even have a lead anymore to protect? So it comes back to the concept of leverage. So I'm not saying every single inning or every single outing needs to be a two-inning save for Kopech. I'm saying the idea that he could be able to do that every now and then based on his history as a starter, I think that is a reasonable thing for them to be trying right now.
I just the biggest reason I don't like it is just it's the way that it's gone so far, I guess, is my biggest issue, because very rarely so far is it Kopech gets the ninth. It's Kopech goes into the eighth, and then he'll probably get the ninth. Like, it's if you're going to do one of these things, like, I guess stick with it. And I don't know. I guess if this was a season to test it out, I guess, like, throw it at a wall. I mean, I guess that's kind of what we're doing with it. But it's something where I just feel like if I'm trying to get the last three outs, I just want the best arm on there and I want him fresh and I want him to be able to only worry about the three outs in front of him. I definitely understand the leverage argument. And maybe we've been a little bit spoiled with kind of always historically having a pretty decent setup guy to be able to handle that eighth inning that we can trust. I would try to develop that eighth inning guy if you want Kopech to be the be your closer. And I just have not seen enough guys that were trying to push into that enough. You know, it feels like Leisure is usually a seventh inning guy, you know, or even a sixth inning guy if you know, we get short on a starter. And
I'm just also not comfortable with just handing Kopech the ninth always in a season where how many times is this damn team going to get to the ninth with a lead? Like, that's a legitimate conversation to have too, to where if you get high leverage, if you have high leverage outs in the eighth inning and you just need to teach him how to pitch in high leverage, let him get those and then potentially get the ninth inning ones too. Cause if I put in Tim Hill or Dominic Leone, I don't know if I'm going to have a lead in the ninth to protect anymore. Like, I think there's an element of that.
And then to go off that, Laz, it's like, if you throw in someone like Hill or Leone or just someone who we maybe not trustable compared to these other guys, you know, let's say they're thinking that, let's say, you know, they give up a lead and then Kopech was supposed to pitch the ninth, then that takes away an outing, you know? So I don't know. I think one interesting thing about Kopech though, is that he hasn't gotten more than three outs in an outing in a month.
That's kind of wild.
He's the last time he got more than three outs in an outing was April 9th. But we've seen him a lot of times come in the eighth, or maybe they were definitely planning on going two innings and it didn't pan out that way. So I don't know. I feel like we're definitely going to see it more often, you know, even though it has been a while. But
that's an interesting point too, though, that, you know, even if they're trying to do this two inning thing, it's not working because he can't even get through the first inning right now.
Yeah,
I don't know. There's still a lot to try and figure out with Michael Kopech in terms of his reliever role, because you're seeing him all out at all times right now.
Yeah,
and it's fun to watch. And I think it's good because your stuff's going to play up. You just got to be able to harness a second pitch and hopefully move from there. That's just my only concern is, yeah, I like the idea of multi-inning. It's not really working, but to the point, it's like, it's not working because he can't get to that second inning based on that first one.
Yeah. Laz, I got a question for you that you mentioned a little tiny thing earlier, and I've seen you tweet about it too. So we've seen Kopech use his fastball a lot. It's 70. He uses it 78% of the time. That's a very staggering number, you know. I know, Duke, you mentioned that, you know, the slider when it's on is on, but hitters are hitting 308 against it. What do you guys think, either of you, about, you know, he does have a curveball. He has a changeup. They were used previously. I know he's been primarily using two pitches, but would you guys think adding a legitimate third pitch? I know there's a cutter too, but is there any value to that?
There is, I would say. And I'd also say, I think part of the reason they're hitting 308 against the slider is the fact that they're coming in knowing, how many fastballs is this guy going to throw before he eventually throws me a slider? Like, I know if I'm seeing by those numbers, four pitches, and he goes fastball, 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 I got a decent chance that this is probably a slider. I'm going to be able to hit it. On the flip side of that, not only just from a hitter standpoint, from a pitcher standpoint, if you're only throwing one pitch 20% of the time and you are just all in on this fastball, how strongly do you feel about that pitch in a given outing? That's always a concern as well. I think it's a fairly good question of, you know, now, if you're going to keep pumping fastballs, do you, instead of just handing all of that additional pitches to the slider, instead of making it like 60-40, do you go like 60-20-20 or like 60-30-10? Like, to your point, do you add in one other thing to give guys to think about? I think that's, if this doesn't work, it's a fair question to start to ask now. Do you have to build on to this?
So I would say, and this is something historically that I feel with any pitchers, I think he should definitely get going with a changeup, because having a changeup, having that very stiff change in speed can be something that he can definitely use to his advantage. It can make his fastball that much more lethal. That, and being able to use a changeup that has a pretty straight or maybe a potential curved drop, can make it so he can always have that pitch away from the batter, whether it's lefty or righty. One of my favorite pitches that a lot of guys who have really good changeups use, actually Drew Thorpe does this really well, is he always attacks the opposite bottom corner of a righty lefter bat, righty or lefty batter with that changeup at the bottom. And it's just enough if they're expecting fastball or if they've gotten fastball or if they've gotten something, say, 90 miles per hour, for example, you know, thinking a little bit more in Drew Thorpe terms. When they get that changeup that's about 10 miles per hour difference that starts out looking like a fastball, it completely sets a batter off his entire game of what he's expecting from that pitch. If Kopech was able to use that fastball and use that changeup more consistently than he uses his slider and kind of use his slider as his wipeout pitch to kind of have that spot right in the middle of like velocity wise, I think that would really keep batters on their toes a little bit more. Regardless if it's a curveball or a changeup, I would prefer a changeup because I don't trust Michael to be able to place a curveball right now. He definitely needs to define that third pitch, and his slider will strengthen more than his fastball off of having that third pitch. And I think his slider can actually become his strength compared to where it's getting hit right now, because he's essentially a two-pitch pitcher as it stands. That's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah, I think the whole reason I kind of bring that up is because there's like two versions of Michael Kopech's fastball I see in outings from him usually. It's either his like, it we'll see like 99 to 102, it's gas, hitters can't touch it. Or the other example is he's throwing like, we'll see like 96. Like you're seeing like a 5, 6, 7 mile an hour difference, you know, from what they could expect down to there. And that just like, that scares me sometimes, seeing only the 96, 97 compared to, you know, when he can throw 101, 102, like getting something, you know, in that like 89 to 92 range, like just as a little bit of a timing difference, I feel like that could be really, really impactful. But he's got to develop it and control it, which we all know that may be a little bit of a work in progress.
Yeah. And what really hurts, especially like guys that only use a four seam fastball, is when you have just kind of that subtle consistency difference that can really negatively affect you, especially against a batter who's expecting fastball, because whether they're going to swing early or not to be able to catch it, to be able to get the early stride on it to pull it, or even if they're able to hit opposite field and get it late, you can time that up and you could still get pretty good contact on it if you're expecting that fastball. That's kind of similar to what happened to Corbin Burnes in Milwaukee. Now, usually what guys do against that would go to either they do a combination of a cutter and a sinker, kind of similar to like what Lance Lynn does, where he has like the cutter, sinker, and then he has another form of the fastball too, or just a straight fastball, I guess. But if you're not able to kind of mix both of those in, just having a fastball that varies miles per hour, if you have a good enough hitter up there, they're going to hit it regardless if they're sitting fastball. So if you kind of want to stay on the upper end of that. So that is definitely worrisome. And that's kind of why it makes me worry about the potential of kind of what we were talking about before with the idea of two innings safe. So we are running a little bit long, but I do want to just ask this super quick. We don't have to get super in detail here. Obviously, we've been talking about pitchers for probably about 20 minutes now. Brett, so there's been a lot of talks about Garrett Crochet potentially being on an innings limit. I think it's almost it's confirmed at this point. Let's be real. And there also has also been discussions about potentially moving Crochet to the bullpen once he hits that limit. Do you think that's a good idea or a bad idea?
I don't hate it. It's just going to be tough once we get to that point, because that's going to mean we need another arm at that point. And we know we do have some arms to call up, you know, I don't hate it. It's just, you know, the way that they're handling him now, they're giving him innings. And if they have a limit on him, he's going to be hitting that limit probably sooner than anyone as a fan might expect. So I feel like it's inevitable at this point, though.
Yeah, I don't have an issue with the idea. I want to know when that would occur. I think we knew this coming into the season, right? Like, and we knew it as soon as they let him go six innings in his first start. They weren't so much concerned about when they hit that innings limit as much as they want to hit that innings limit. And they're going to do it if it happens in June, if it happens in August. They're going to let him go out there and prove that he can be a starter. Totally fine with that. We'll see where it ends up. If it ends up in the bullpen, fine. But I think more likely he's going to hit an innings limit, and then they're going to say you got 20 more, so we're not going to waste you at the major league level. Maybe we'll send you to Charlotte to finish things off. That would be another way of going about it, just because, like you're saying, Brett, you need another arm, but Crochet's healthy, so you can't just bring up another arm. You need to replace him, essentially. That's where the Charlotte idea comes from. But either way, so far I'm happy with how they're handling this. I think it's similar to what we had talked about in the offseason.
So I think the way I would do it, and this is going to be unpopular as all hell, it always is. I think once he hits the innings limit and you think that you've seen enough for it, that you have the idea that he can be a potential workhorse, potential number one starter long term, shut him down completely and start a throwing program. Let him do something outside of the mount, like outside of major league games. Like if you're genuinely worried about the potential wear and tear on the arm, don't dick around with him in the bullpen. I don't really care to see him pitch meaningless innings in Charlotte either. That might be the idea of a roster move if we were to do that to get him potentially off the roster. I think Major League Baseball will not give us too much flack if we find a reason to be able to get him on the IL for the rest of the season. Shut him down, get him on a good off-season work program, and then go into next season with no idea of a limit. Then we're letting him loose. That's how I would personally go about it.
I'm just so curious what the number is going to be. I hope it's at least 110, 115. We'll see what happens, though.
Yeah, because he's already, you know, about to surpass his biggest yearly total in the majors. So, and, you know, probably I don't hate 110 or so, right around doubling his career high.
Yeah, 120 is a number I always kind of have in my head as far as like pitchers getting shut down. I think that's what Strasburg's inning limit was. It might have been a little bit higher back when he was kind of on the up and up. And that's kind of like the program most people like run as far as like inning limits, but it's such a, that's going to be such an interesting case study. It already is, but even a couple more years, maybe 5-10 years down the road, just seeing how much like starting pitchers have been protected as far as like inning limits and stuff like that, it's going to be interesting to see like how that ends up panning out, because like we see like a Strasburg, his arm kind of just failed him at a certain point in his career. Matt Harvey, very good example of that. It's a very interesting study as well. And then there's flip side where it does work for some guys as well. So it's going to be interesting to see. But I think if we're going to go straight shutdown approach, just shut him down. Don't mess around with it. Like keep him at the facility. Just have him start his program heading to next year with the idea that we're going to let him loose. And that's going to be it. That's how I would personally go about it. But I think there's positives and negatives to each one. But I could talk all day, like I said, about pitching. So we should probably end this podcast. Brett, it's been great having you on, buddy. Very much appreciate the insight. You're always welcome on the pod. It was great having you on. I would really enjoy to have like as many Sox on 35th, like personalities on here as possible. But you know, you're a guy I've always liked on Twitter. I've drank with you until I can't see straight in Lot B before. So, I mean, it's always great to pick your brain a little bit, you know, especially with a guy I've lost brain cells with. So
appreciate it, Duke. Les, great time talking baseball with you guys. Gonna look forward to some more in the future.
Oh, we'll have you back on for sure with this. Like Duke said, it's nice to have more of the Sox on 35th crew on here. It's something we've wanted to do as we started up this podcast. We need to be better at it. And I think Nick's absence this week has given us the perfect time. So glad to have you on.
Oh, yeah. It sure worked out. We had some good conversations. Really glad I could make an appearance.
Absolutely. But, ladies and gentlemen, that's all we have this week for the Sox on 35th podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcast. Also, be sure to check out the website, SoxOn35th.com, as well as following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at SoxOn35th to stay up to date with yo, Chicago White Sox. This has been Duke Coughlin, joined by Jordan Lazowski and Brett Hafner. Me and Jordan will be back next week, at least. Brett, sorry. And Nick will be back as we cover another week of White Sox baseball. Southside, stand up. Thank you, and go Sox.
Go Sox.
Go Sox. Go Sox.